we come to a tremendous place to end our study, and that is the beginning of Christianity. That is the empty tomb. So I encourage you to turn back to the Gospel of Mark in chapter 15. I'm going to approach this a little differently. We're going to give some facts related to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and I want to give you six reasons why Christianity should have, humanly speaking, been finished. We need to review chapter 15, verses 43 to 45 would help us if we begin there. Look at verse 43 with me. Let's begin, in fact, with verse 42. And when evening had come, because it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea came, a prominent member of the council. You'll notice that he's part of the Sanhedrin that had declared Jesus guilty of death. And we don't know, but perhaps Joseph had remained silent through all of the illegal courtroom proceedings. But he was a prominent member of the council, and he himself was waiting for the kingdom. Now, we don't know if there had been a change in his life, but the word waiting is in the imperfect tense. It's a periphrastic imperfect, which means that every chance this man had, he was waiting or thinking about the kingdom. It was constantly on his mind. When he got out of bed in the morning, he thought, maybe today is the day the kingdom will come. So this man evidently was a man of faith, hanging on to the slim threads of hope that he had that Jesus was in fact that king. And he gathered up courage and went in before Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. If he had not asked for the body, the customs of that day would have taken place. That is, that they would have buried Jesus in the Valley of Hinnom, known as the Valley of Ashes or the Valley of Corpses, where they kept a fire perpetually burning, and the bodies of criminals were thrown into that valley and consumed by the fire. So if he had not asked for the body, Jesus would, of course, been buried in the Valley of Hinnom. He gathered up courage and went into Pilate and asked for the body. And Pilate was a little surprised. He wondered if Jesus was dead. It was a little early. And so he summoned the centurion and he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. You could underline the two words dead in verse 44. He was dead. He was already dead. And ascertaining this from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. I think the first reason why Christianity was finished was because Jesus was dead. He'd been crucified. The Persians created this cruel death. They worshipped one of their particular gods was the god of the earth. And so they didn't want to defile the sod with the body of a dead criminal. And so they devised a way that a criminal would die above the ground. And so they came up with this idea of crucifixion. They would elevate the body of this criminal 12, 10 feet into the air. It was a horrible death. We have witnesses by not only the centurion, but by the soldiers that were there. And no one ever denied the fact that he had in fact died. He was dead. Should have been finished. The second reason that I think, humanly speaking, Christianity was all over was because his body was mummified with over 100 pounds of spices. Turn back to John, or ahead to John, and let's take a look at this practice. John chapter 19, verses 39 and 40. And Nicodemus came also, who had first come to him by night. Now we have two men involved, not only Joseph of Arimathea, but Nicodemus. You remember this wealthy man. And he came by night, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. It was the practice in that day to mummify the body with spices, both powder and liquid, and it took a lot of money. Nicodemus, being a wealthy man, was able to buy an amount used for a royal person's death and burial, 100 pounds of spices. And he purchased these. And so they took the body, verse 40, and they bound it in linen wrappings. It's plural. The other gospel writers will talk about a linen sheet. Evidently, they had a sheet. They took it to the tomb, and they then cut it into strips, as the practice was. And they would lay the body down on a stone tablet there in the tomb, and they would then begin to wrap every limb of his body in these linen wrappings, the swathe. You remember that Jesus was wrapped in the swathe when he was born as a little baby. That's all they had to bury him in was linen sheet. That's all they had to wrap him in as a baby was a linen sheet, his poor birth. And they would wrap every limb of his body and interlay spices. So by the time they're finished, this individual is completely hidden from sight. He is wrapped completely with who knows how many yards of linen wrappings, and then they would lay another separate piece on his face that they referred to as the linen handkerchief. And interwoven into these linens were at least 100 pounds of spices. We're going to refer back to this a little later in the sermon, but I want you to understand the practice, and it was done with Jesus as well. So he was mummified there in the tomb. They made the tombs in such a way that along the side would be a trough cut out, and they would lay the body in that trough or that ledge. It would be elevated at a particular point where they would, of course, they would put the head on that elevated position. And so there he was, crucified. He was dead, and now he is mummified. There's no way he can breathe through 100 pounds of spices and linen wrappings. He's dead, naturally speaking or humanly speaking. Then he is placed, of course, in a solid tombstone, number 3, and a stone is rolled in front. He was placed in the garden, verse 41, in a new tomb. You've heard people refer to him being buried in a borrowed tomb. I don't think it was borrowed. I think it was permanent. I don't think Joseph of Arimathea ever thought that he'd be buried there. I think he felt like he was giving away this tomb to the body of Jesus, and it was all over. And then you notice a stone was rolled in front. One of the other gospel writers tells us, in fact, why don't you turn back to chapter 27 of Matthew and just hold your finger there. Chapter 27 of Matthew, and we're going to look at several verses here, but for now, let's look at Matthew chapter 29, 59, and 60. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out of solid rock. No back doors here, no exits. This is solid rock. And he rolled a large stone, or he had many servants roll the stone against the entrance of the tomb, and then he went away. Now, the custom of this day, if you were wealthy enough, you could have your own tomb, and of course have it on your own private property, as he did. And then they would dig a trough that would run in front of that tomb. And uphill, they would have a large stone that had been cut out of solid rock, and it was kept in place, perhaps by a smaller rock, placed in front of this huge boulder. And at a particular time when the body had been deposited in the tomb, they'd pull out that smaller rock, and gravity would do the work that would take more than 30 or 40 men to do. That is, it would roll this stone to a resting place directly in front of the tomb. In fact, we have an ancient manuscript. The man who was translating, or I should say copying, the Gospel of Mark makes a side note in the margin of his text. He says that they rolled this stone that more than 20 men could not budge or move. He would give his interpretive comments that were not part of the text, but it just struck him that such a huge tomb had such a huge rock. In fact, engineers have discovered by studying the typical tombs of that day that the opening would be somewhere between 5 and 5.5 feet high so that you could bend down and go into that tomb and do the work. And they estimated that for a rock to be large enough to cover a tomb with a 5.5 foot opening, that rock would have to be at least 1.5 to 2 tons in weight, just to be large enough to cover the entrance of that tomb. This was no small feat. And I imagine when the stone came to rest in front of that tomb, that Joseph walked away, and whatever disciples had been there, perhaps, the women we know were there, they left with their heads hanging low, thinking, this is tragic. You see, I want you to understand that you and I know the end of the chapter. We know the end of the story, but don't let that take away from you the agony that these people felt that, humanly speaking, it's finished. He's dead. He's mummified. He's buried. Now, Matthew chapter 27, verses 62 to 65, give us the fourth point, and that is that a Roman guard was positioned to guard the tomb. Now, look at verse 62. And on the next day, which is the one after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I am to rise again.'" Now, if he's deceiving, why would they even worry? But notice what they say. They say, "Sir, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day." Why? Well, they say, lest the disciples come and steal him away, but I think they're trying to keep him in. Just in case he really is, let's take every precaution to keep him in that tomb. And so they said, however, masking their fear that he was really the king, "Lest the disciples come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He is risen from the dead,' and the last deception will be worse than the first." If they were really afraid that the disciples would come along and steal the body out of the grave and falsify his resurrection, they would know it would be a hoax. You would think the Pharisees would leave the rock off and leave the guards away so that when the body's missing, they can say, "Look, we didn't guard it. We didn't put a stone in front of it. And they obviously came in the night and stole it." I bet you at the end of this thing, they kind of smacked themselves on the head and they said, why did we take every precaution that proves that something supernatural happened? Why in the world did we come up with the idea that we put a guard there? How are the disciples going to overcome 16 armed guards? They probably wished they'd left it alone. And yet, how clever God is in his plan, they did exactly that. So they secured a Roman guard. Verse 65, Pilate said to them, you have a guard, or take a guard, literally. Go, make it as secure as you know how. And they went and made the guard secure. Along with the guard, they set a seal on the stone. Now, you need to understand that this Roman guard is not like many artists portray this setting. You've seen the paintings, you know, two or three cute-looking guys in miniskirts standing out in front of this tomb, holding a couple of cardboard swords. This isn't it at all. The guard referred here, the Greek word indicates that this was the fighting machine of the Roman army. A unit guard would be anywhere from 4 to 16 men, armed to the teeth. These men would be the most powerful defensive and offensive weapon of the entire Roman army. In fact, these men were trained to guard 6 square feet from attack. They were specifically trained to be able to cover and protect and guard 6 square feet. And there were at least 4 of these men guarding at least 16 square feet, armed with spears and swords, daggers, coats of mail, and all kinds of protective and defensive and offensive materials. So I would say then that one of the reasons you could say that Christianity is finished is not only is he crucified and mummified and buried, put in a solid rock tomb with a stone in front, but there's this guard, this impressive guard that nobody will ever get through. We might as well chalk up Christianity as being finished. But let me give you another reason that naturally speaking, or humanly speaking, it would be over with, and that was the last part of the verse I just read. They set a seal on the stone. They set a seal. Verse 66, and they went and made the grave secure. And along with the guard, they set a seal on the stone. This is the same thing that they did with Daniel the prophet. It was the practice that once the boulder was placed in front of the tomb, that they would take a rope, perhaps some kind of twine, and they would attach it to one side of the tomb with special sealing clay. And then they would wrap that thread or that rope around the stone and attach it to the other side of the tomb with sealing clay, and then the Roman authority would take a ring and press it into the clay, and it, in effect, said that all of the authority of Rome is saying, don't touch this rock. Practice had it that if you touched it, if they could come along and prove that you had removed this seal, you were crucified upside down. So all of the Roman authority is declaring, it's over with, last chapter, don't mess with this tomb. And then number 6, we know from studying the accounts of the Gospels, the disciples were now in hiding. The disciples were in hiding. Their credibility is gone. Their message is silent. Some kingdom cause. This thing's really going to take off. These men are afraid to show their faces. They had fled the moment Jesus had been arrested in the garden, and now they're in hiding, perhaps in John's home. And I imagine as I try to crawl into the skin of one of those disciples, I would probably be feeling tremendous confusion. I would be stunned into silence. I'd spent 3 years of my life following this man and hearing the claim he was the king, and now he's dead. Perhaps I would be feeling angry or bitter. Their lips were quiet. And then what happened next, you know, divinely speaking, Christianity would not be finished, but would flourish. Let me give you some reasons to jot into your notes. First of all, we find that the feared Roman power was ignored and the seal was broken. They put up the seal. They declared that if you touch this, you are declaring war on the entire Roman Empire. And if caught, you would be crucified upside down. There is the implication in that the seal was broken in this. Somebody more powerful than Rome has come onto the scene. Somebody willing to take on the entire Roman Empire has shown himself. The seal is broken. Now we know that to be the power of God. It will take on any kingdom. One day we'll rule the world. Now I want you to turn back to John again, John chapter 20. We're trying to put together some of these gospel accounts to get the fullest picture possible. John chapter 20, verse 1, and the second point is that the stone had been rolled away. You know well the story. You've heard it many times, but let's take another look. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary came early to the tomb while it was still dark. It's interesting that all the disciples were cowards, and yet all the women were courageous. And they saw, or she saw, the stone already taken away from the tomb. Now, if we put together the gospel writers, the words here are interesting. There's a little Greek word that each gospel writer would attach a different preposition to give us the picture of where this stone is. For your interest, Mark suggests by his preposition that the stone is rolled uphill. It is rolled up, and the preposition he puts on front of coolio means that it's rolled up. The other gospel writer, Luke, says that it's rolled up and away from. He adds what Mark says in rolling up, and he says it's not only rolled up, but it's rolled away from the tomb. It's separated from the tomb. You notice what Mary saw? Look at verse 20, or verse 1 again of chapter 20, the last part. She saw the stone had been taken, you notice, away from the tomb. Now this gives us an even fuller picture because John adds the preposition that not only is it up and away, but he implies by that preposition that somebody has carried it away. Somebody has literally picked up a 2-ton rock and moved it, not just up that gully, up the hill, but moved it away as if it's been thrown aside. And you see, this is fascinating because everybody that comes back on the scene knows that somebody very strong, at least, or perhaps 50 men have gotten a hold of this rock and somehow gotten it out of the gully and moved it away from the sepulcher, and it's lying on its side as if somebody just tossed it like a pebble. The picture is beginning to unfold that something awesome has happened. Number 3, the Roman guard fled, and they had to be bribed. Now Matthew 28 tells us about this, and we won't take time to turn, but you could jot in that reference, Matthew 28:11. We know that an earthquake took place. Maybe the earthquake was caused by that 2-ton rock hitting the ground and bouncing all over the place. But whatever it was, these men were paralyzed with fear. Finally, when they got their senses about them, they fled. Did they go back to the army barracks? No, they went back, it says, to the Jewish authorities. Because after they had gained their senses, they looked into this tomb and they found that it was empty. They're in trouble. And now they're really in trouble because they have fled in fear the scene. They're AWOL. Now the Romans had a key little practice that if you went AWOL back in that day, you were killed. You lost your head. And so they went to the chief priests asking, first of all, for protection. Because they asked them to go to Pilate and declare that something supernatural had happened. That they hadn't fallen asleep. But the chief priests say, okay, we'll take care of Pilate, but we want you to say this. We want you to say you were sleeping. Now, for this guard to say they were sleeping, they would have to be bribed. Because if they were caught, found, first of all, without their arms, they could be killed. If they struck an officer higher up, they could be killed. If they deserted their post, they could be killed. And if they were caught sleeping, they could be killed. And they're saying, wait, you want us to tell Pilate what? That we were sleeping? And the disciples came while we were sleeping and took the body? How much is it worth to you? And I really believe, and we'll have to read between the lines of the most ancient manuscripts, that these chief priests gave these guards, I think, enough money for them to retire on. Because had Pilate agreed and protected them, their credibility as soldiers was gone. This was the fighting unit, and all 16 of them were taking a nap. The credibility of their prowess in battle was finished. They were foolish before the eyes of their comrades, and they probably gave them enough money to comfortably retire. So they were bribed. Bribed as well because their lives were in jeopardy. Now, number 4, both the Jews and the Romans admitted the tomb was empty. You see, it's fascinating, ladies and gentlemen, that they never denied that the tomb wasn't empty. No, you were mistaken. Let's go back to the tomb, and I'm sure they did. In fact, I'll bet the entire city of Jerusalem went to that tomb to take a peek. The stone, they saw that. If the Pharisees had not moved it, put it back in the trench. They came and they saw the tomb. The Romans declared by silence that it is in fact empty. They never denied it. You know, this lends me just to a to a brief moment to declare once again the tremendous hatred and jealousy of Jesus Christ that these Pharisees and religious leaders had toward him. It was bad enough to see him heal the blind man, to see him raise the dead and reject him. They began by rejecting his words, and then they rejected his works. And ultimately, that leads to rejecting him as a person. The same happens in your life and in my life. You reject his words that he is the Savior. You reject his works in what you see in the lives of other believers, as John testified. And you reject the tremendous transformation that has taken place in the lives of people you know. You will one day ultimately reject him, as you are in part now. But it's tragic after this that we didn't have a revival among the Sanhedrinists. You'd think that they'd call a meeting and say, "Look, men, we really made a mistake. There's no doubt in our minds now that this man is really God. Did you see that rock? Let's figure out the facts. That was the tomb, and now he's gone. And we've had to bribe these soldiers to lie." How in the world could they live with themselves knowing they bribed the soldiers to tell a lie when the soldiers came back and said, "You won't believe what's happened. An earthquake, the stone, paralyzed with fear, the body's gone." And yet they continued to reject him. I really think, my friends, and we're going to go on, but I think if Jesus Christ had appeared to the Roman Empire and had declared his kingship and had set up a throne and visibly reigned, that they would still reject him. And so would you and I, had we been there. Number five. This is fascinating. The grave clothes were undisturbed. Look at verse 6 of John chapter 20. They were undisturbed. "Simon Peter therefore also came following him and entered the tomb, and he beheld the linen wrappings lying there," literally lying in their folds. Now you remember 72 plus hours have passed since Jesus has been put in this mummified state. In these hours, in the coolness of that tomb, the encasing that he had been placed in would grow hard. In fact, it would become like cement. These linen wrappings would harden with the spices, and it would become something like a shell, like a cocoon. And they step into that tomb, and they look into that tomb, and they see the linen wrappings not scattered all over, not lying all about that tomb, but still in their wrappings or still in their folds. Literally, still shaped like a man. It's like seeing a body laying on a bed and the sheets over the bed, and you can see the head, and you can go down and you can see the feet sticking up. But there's no body in there. You see, these wrappings were still lying in their folds. Obviously, Jesus Christ had simply evaporated out of those folds. And the linen napkin is still laying right in its place. And it suggests that it's even been folded. It's like Jesus evaporated out of that thing, like he kind of evaporated through the walls. Remember, he went to see his disciples? He had that power. He evaporated out of that cast, out of that shell, and he left everything right there, just like it had been when he'd been left. There are three words used for saw or for see. Underline the word saw in chapter 20, verse 1. You see that? Then underline the same word translated in my Bible, beheld, in verse 6. And in verse 8, you'll see it again. And I want to pause for just a moment because there's a powerful truth in here. There are three different Greek words used, and it's giving us the three ways that you and I respond to truth. It says that Mary came and she saw the stone. The word is blepo, which means that she saw and she never even thought for a moment what had occurred. She just simply saw and she took off and ran. In fact, she comes back and look what she says in verse 2. "They've taken away the Lord out of the tomb and we do not know where they have laid him." So she didn't really catch on to anything of what had happened. She simply saw and she took off running. The next word in verse 6, beheld, is the word theoreo, from which we get our English word theorize. Peter comes in and he enters the tomb and he beheld the linen wrappings there, and the face cloth, which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. And he simply saw all of those facts, and he began to theorize. That is, he began to count up 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals. And about that time, when he's trying to figure it all up, it says that John, in verse 8, saw, the word is horao, he saw and believed. You see, some people see, and yet they see without seeing. They see blindly. Some see the facts, and then they begin to theorize. Isn't this fascinating? You know, I wonder what occurred here, and they begin to run through their mind all the different possibilities. But yet John, with a heart of faith, came in and hurrah, he saw with a heart of understanding, implied in the definition of that Greek word. He saw and he believed. And there are people today that do the same. I want to give you another reason that proves, in some small part, that Christianity would flourish. Number six, the women were selected as the first witnesses. And this is kind of fascinating because in that day, if you were a woman, your testimony didn't hold up in court. In fact, if you saw somebody killed and you were a woman and you stood there and you watched it all and you knew where the murderer lived, you had the address, you had all the facts, and you came and reported it, wouldn't matter. You're a woman. Your testimony would not hold up in court. But isn't it interesting that all the gospel writers tell us that the first witnesses that Jesus Christ was alive were women? Now think for just a moment. If this whole thing had been fabricated, don't you think the disciples would have had a little more savvy than come up with some credible person as the first eyewitness and not have included women because they knew that didn't matter? These disciples are kind of dumb. And yet it works in the reverse, proving that they did not fabricate this testimony, because had they, women would have been left out. But they are so bold as to declare that women were the first to see him. And then on top of that, Christ was seen by more than 500 other people. It's one thing to be seen by one or two or three or four people. And they could get together and they could say, okay, now let's get the facts together. But it's another thing to be seen by 500 plus, and all of them agree that Jesus is alive. Reminds me of the story of the teacher who had four boys skip the morning classes in high school, and they came back and they told the teacher, we missed classes because we had a flat tire. And she immediately separated the four boys, and once she had separated them, she asked them, all right, write down on a piece of paper which tire it was. Smart. Well, you get 500 people together, plus the disciples, including the two men on the road to Emmaus, plus the women. Somewhere along the line, we're going to have a problem. And yet they all agree that he's alive. All right, now we got to wrap this up. But let me give you a couple of things, because had you been there and had you been a religious leader, you got to think fast. So they called an immediate council. All right, men, let's not accept them. Let's find an answer to what happened out here. And let me give you a few that have been propagated throughout history, and then we'll close. Number one, obviously the disciples faked it by stealing the body. I would have loved to have been a lawyer living at this time and had a chance to cross-examine one of those soldiers. You see, because the Pharisees told them, look, you tell everybody. In fact, by the way, they sent representatives out from Jerusalem to all of Macedonia telling the story that he had been stolen. They were so dead set on getting the word out that he'd been stolen, they were fearful that the truth would get out. So they said to the soldiers, tell him you were sleeping. And the disciples came and stole the body. I'd love to get one of those guards up on a stand. All right, let's start from the beginning. What happened? Well, I fell asleep. Then what happened? Well, the disciples came and stole the body. Well, wait a second. If you were sleeping, how did you know it was one of the disciples that stole the body? When did you begin sleeping with your eyes open? You see, their entire theory is riddled with problems. Never even hold up in a court. And let me say one other point about this. If the disciples had indeed stolen the body, if they had fabricated all of this story, if they'd made it up, do you think that a lie would have turned them from cowards to crusaders? Do you really think that they would have been willing to come from being trembling, fearful men in hiding to now martyrs of the church, willing to die as they all would do? Oh no, they wouldn't do that for a lie, but they'd do it for the truth. The second theory that is propagated or fabricated by the leaders and even by those today is that the authorities stole the body. And that's even more brilliant. The authorities came along and they stole the body. Now that makes a lot of sense, because where did the church begin? Jerusalem, the hometown of these religious leaders. And what was the major message? Jesus is alive! So what do you think the authorities should have done? Produced a dead body. I think they would have paraded the body of Jesus all around Jerusalem, and that would have crushed Christianity right then and there. But the authorities who supposedly stole the body never produced the body. There's a third that's propagated even today. It's called the Passover plot. Briefly, I could tell you that this is all a charade, that what Jesus was an imposter, and he's come along and he wants to be the Messiah, okay? And he knows the Old Testament, and he knows all the prophecies related to his death and his burial and his resurrection. So in order to be the Messiah, and in order to fool everybody into thinking that he's really the Messiah, he's going to go to the cross and plan it, and yet fake his death. And he's going to make sure that he's taken off the cross before he's dead, and you notice they didn't break his legs. That's proof. He never really was dead. And then once he's in the tomb, the disciples will come and take him out, and he will present himself to all of Jerusalem as the living Lord. This is called the Passover plot. However, the whole thing is ruined by one soldier who got out of line, and for crying out loud, he speared the Lord. That wasn't part of the plot. He wasn't supposed to do that. But some over-anxious soldier, to prove that Jesus had died, took his spear and he plunged it into the side of Jesus, perhaps even piercing the heart. And as a result, Jesus did in fact die. He never was the Messiah. It was all a plot, and he did die and never rose again. Now, this whole plot hinges around the fact that the spear was thrust into the side, and secondly, that there were never any soldiers at the tomb, so that the disciples could come in and get the body and of course, bury him silently. Now, there's a problem with this. The propagator of this Passover plot that's living today, from what I understand, he says that there weren't any guards because the only gospel account of guards guarding the tomb is Matthew. But if he'd read the other accounts, he would realize that the only gospel account of a spear being plunged into the side, thus ruining the plot, is only found in John. So why decline to accept Matthew, because he's the only one, and yet take as a central part the fact that the Passover plot, as presented in John, was shattered by the soldier piercing the side of Jesus? You see what they're doing? They're picking and choosing. They're taking this because that makes sense to our view, and we're going to discard all of this. One other view is the swoon or the resuscitation theory. And of course, this is the theory that Jesus Christ, of course, went through all of the trials. He was beaten half to death and the halfway death, flogged. He was so weak that he couldn't even carry the crossbeam, and he is finally crucified. They nailed spikes into his forearms or wrists and his feet, and finally he's declared dead, but he's really not. Then he is mummified with over 100 pounds of spices, placed in a tomb, guarded by soldiers. But guess what happens? After 3 days of not eating and not drinking, instead of growing even weaker from all that's happened, he grows stronger. And he breaks out of the shell of his linen wrappings. He pushes over a 2-ton stone, takes on 16 soldiers, and declares himself the King of Jerusalem. Two others, and I'm just going to name them and briefly describe them, and then we'll wrap it up. First of all, there's the wrong tomb theory, and that's simple. The disciples got their directions mixed up, and so that when they went to the tomb to see Jesus, they went to one that was empty. They went to the wrong one. And that means, of course, that the Roman soldiers were at the wrong one, and Pilate had sent them to the wrong one, and the Pharisees and religious rulers had all gone to the wrong one as well. They were just all confused. And then there's the hallucination theory. That means that nobody ever really saw Jesus. He never really came out of the grave, but everybody hallucinated. That is, the 500 witnesses were hallucinating. The women hallucinated. The disciples hallucinated. In fact, all of Jerusalem about now is hallucinating. Oh, my friends, you know, these views would be more of a miracle as just simply believing the records of the gospel accounts, the falsehood that we see in the leaders, and simply coming to the conclusion that what Jesus said he would do, he did. He came out of the tomb. There's really no other way to explain it. There's no way to fabricate the truth unless you deny or ignore the obvious. Now, let me say one thing. Just as Jesus said he would come into the world, he came. And he fulfilled all the prophetic elements of Old Testament prophets and what they gave. Just as was prophesied the Lamb would be slain for the sins of many, Jesus Christ died. And they even declared that he would be buried, and he was in fact buried. If all of those add up and turn out to be so, what about the last thing that we're waiting for? That Jesus is going to come again. That he will come back and rule and reign, not only for the 1,000-year millennial kingdom, but ultimately forever. That as well is true. You and I have the privilege of standing on this side of these other three events, and we've seen them to be true. Let's not ignore the facts that Jesus will come again. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the privilege of rejoicing, exalting, worshiping a living Lord. And though men would fabricate the truth, and though men would make up lies, though men would seek to counterfeit what actually happened, we declare that we believe and we worship you not as a dead Lord, not as one who's lying somewhere in a forgotten tomb that was mistaken, not someone who's been burned in the valley of Hinnom, but someone who literally came back from the dead. And Lord, we thank you as we recognize that you did all of this for us. And you, O God, as you planned the salvation for mankind and the promise, you gave us such detail, such a wonderful plan that someone would die for us. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for such a beautiful story.